Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, December 5th, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on New York City following the historic victory of Democratic Socialist mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani and how the Latino vote played a role in his victory. And so joining us on the show today is Chris Seda Chavrier, who's a bilingual reporter and photojournalist. Chris's latest article in NECLA is entitled How Mamdani Won Over Latinos in New York City. Chris joins us from New York City. Welcome to the show, Chris Seda Chavrier.
Hi, hello. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let me just say that on this program, I don't usually follow these sort of electoral horse races, both on and off election year or midterms or in greater election years per se. But one thing that caught my imagination with this particular political race in New York City is that at the very least, and I think you mentioned it both in your NECLA article and Zoran Mamdani mentioned it in his victory speech as well, is that we can't predict whether or not he's going to live up to all the promises he made, but at the very least, he has defeated a corrupt political system within the Democratic Party at the very least. So let's begin by going back to 2024 following the presidential election, where in New York, we saw an unusual but understandable phenomenon of people voting for Donald Trump for president, but also voting for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, for representative. It was unusual in its contradiction, but understandable as a statement of discontent with the Democratic Party's status quo. So prior to this election in New York, what was the conventional wisdom held by pollsters towards the Latino community, and how did Zoran break that conventional wisdom?
Right. So basically, I think a lot of people in New York treat Latinos as a bit of a monolith, which is a mistake for many reasons. I mean, the word Latino is already so, you know, a source of controversy, because you're basically saying that everyone from Latin America has one identity in the United States. So it's not a monolith. And I think a lot of people have really struggled with how to reach this community. And so what you have in New York is basically, you already have kind of this establishment, I don't know, political machine, you could call it, in which, you know, you have Puerto Ricans, Dominicans kind of already having made their path in politics. And so a lot of the ways politicians reach out would be through that institutional means, right? Through other politicians kind of endorsing them, or going through, how do I say this? Going through churches or community groups. And so what happened with Trump, and with some people voting for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Trump, that was specifically kind of the Jackson Heights area, Jackson Heights, Corona. And you did see a lot of people like favoring Trump. I remember I was reporting around that neighborhood just before the election, and you would hear even people who are immigrants saying that Trump will be good for us, mostly because of affordability, because, you know, inflation was so high. But I think also a little bit out of the sense that, like, the immigration situation in New York was, you know, kind of this crisis. A lot of people perceived it this way. You know, it was this sudden influx that the city couldn't really, you know, the city really struggled to deal with it. And I think with those two things, like affordability and also the perceived crisis in New York with immigration, drove a lot of immigrants to vote for Trump. And just to add that, you know, just like it's not a monolith in terms of ethnicity or country, it's also not a monolith in terms of ideology, right? I feel like a lot of Latinos, they kind of vote pragmatically across lines. They maybe don't stick to a party as much as people would think so, right? So I think that's why people voted for Trump, right? It was, you know, affordability, immigration, and also not necessarily feeling identified with the Democrats anymore. But what people, I think, really made a mistake is they saw this happening and they thought this was kind of like written in stone, right? That it would always be this way. This was like a fundamental shift. And then with Mamdani, what we saw was it wasn't, right? Like, this electorate is still pragmatic. This electorate voted for Mamdani because they were worried about affordability. Yeah. They supported him because now they don't agree with how Trump is dealing with the situation.
Yeah, and I'll go back again to say, and I got this from your article, which is this feeling of a statement of discontent with the Democratic Party's status quo, which is something that I feel like we'll revisit again during the course of this conversation, along with the concept of the Latino vote, this monolith, as you correctly mentioned. Now, for those that don't follow these type of electoral politics, can you tell us about the concept of triple prime voters, in your own words, and how they sort of seem to ignore voters of color here? Because I think this sort of adds to the discontent that you may have described already here.
Right. Triple prime voters are people who have voted in the last three primary elections. And the idea is that it's worth reaching out to these people because they already identify with the party and they're already likely to go out and vote, right? Because they're very involved electorally. But the problem with that is that you're writing off a huge amount of people. So you're writing off people who are working class. So maybe they're not paying that much attention to a primary versus a general election. You're writing out students, you're writing out young people. You're writing out so much people just to get to this tiny slice of the electorate that's the slice you're going to be competing for, right, with the other politicians. And I'll just say this worked out. I don't think this is very democratic, but, you know, as other people have pointed out, the Democratic primary for mayor is held on off-year elections and in June. So that's already like not very democratic, right? So people are, politicians are just competing for this small slice of the vote, which obviously, you know, the idea is that they don't really would go for someone like Mamdani because they're usually older, they have the time to do this, wealthier. And so Mamdani, what he did, which is kind of genius, is that, you know, his campaign saw that and was like, we have to expand the electorate. Like, we're not going to win just appealing to those voters. We have to appeal to people who don't vote and who are likely to support us because they're young, because they're working class, because, you know, they're people who have been left outside the mainstream. And so that's what he did. And so his campaign was geared to those people, right? So with that kind of small army of volunteers, I think it was over 100,000.
Wow.
You know, these people weren't, yeah, these people weren't just knocking on one door once. They were going there several times, right? They were establishing a relationship with these people. It wasn't just, you know, I'm going to send you the flyer or this politician endorsed me, so you should endorse me. Which, by the way, it's not really working anymore with, you know, social media, this whole new way of doing politics. But yeah, like, for example, in the Bronx, I went on one canvassing event, and it was very surprising because they had lists of the persons they were reaching out to. And, you know, they would mark it. And then if they hadn't been able to talk to one person in one door because no one answered, then they would go back to that door in another canvassing event. And when I talked to the canvassers, they told me they would go back once, two, three, five times to the same person. Because it wasn't just like, please vote for Mamdani. It was also like reminding people that they have to go vote at a certain time, that early voting is starting. You know, really, I think, walking people through politics in New York, which is not something that has happened before. So, yeah, I think Mamdani really managed to bring people into the fold of New York politics that was very exclusive of other groups. Yeah.
I'm fascinated with the concept of triple prime voters because, okay, maybe you could get away with that scenario in Salt Lake City or Denver or somewhere in Iowa or Nebraska. But the idea being applied in New York City makes no sense to me. And so I don't know why status quo people like Andrew Cuomo would even follow or even entertain that idea in the first place, especially in New York City. But I digress. Now, obviously, there have been a lot of post-mortem articles on Mamdani's victory in New York City. Your article in NACLA in particular, I find it refreshing because, as you just mentioned, you spoke to a few volunteers for this article, and most of their work was in the Bronx that you just mentioned. You also mentioned Queens in your article, but how did the Bronx sort of serve as the best example of voter frustration, and how did volunteers help residents in relating to Zohran's message? Because the Bronx has historically been, and one could argue still remains, one of the poorest boroughs in New York City. But again, how does the Bronx here serve as the best example to the thesis of your article here?
So the Bronx is really fascinating because it went so hard for Cuomo, right? And it's been written off in part because the turnout is pretty low. And for example, it's also a lot of elderly people who turn out. So I went to a Cuomo event just before the primary, and it was a lot of elderly, you know, women, seniors who voted for Cuomo, right? But when I spoke to these people, it was very interesting because, like I said, I went with them to go canvass in the Bronx, and they would have, you know, they would go again and again to these doors. And when I spoke to, I think it was Claudia Abreu, she was a volunteer there, and she told me that she was very disappointed when the primary, you know, he lost it to Cuomo. But the volunteers realized that the areas they had canvassed there actually went to Mamdani. And so that's when people in the Bronx, they really started putting boots on the ground, and they turned out the Bronx for Mamdani. And so that kind of shows really his tragedy. You know, it's this low turnout, you know, borough that has been written off. And suddenly he puts a bunch of volunteers there and they build these relationships with the community. And so the community voted for him. And I think, like you said, it's kind of symbolic of the larger coalition he managed to cobble together and really, you know, deliver this historic upset.
Yeah, and I think you cited Ana Maria Archila, who's the co-director of Make the World and the Working Families Party, sort of saying something to the same extent that people are frustrated with Democrats, and which is why they voted for Trump last year. And now they're going in the other direction 1 year later, seeing how everything has gone, to say the least. Now, canvassing for voters, generally speaking, is not an easy thing to do, especially in an off-election year, as you just mentioned. Yet volunteers did a pretty good job in doing the little things, like meeting working-class New Yorkers where they were at, in places like the New York City Marathon, the Puerto Rican Day Parade, churches, mosques, etc. I think even during the mayoral debates, Cuomo was being questioned as to why he had not visited a mosque up to that point in this election year. But as simple as this may sound, does it also speak volumes to the disconnected nature of Andrew Cuomo's style of politicking to more moderate voters? Because again, moderate voters, now that it occurs to me, is another way to say triple prime voters, which you mentioned earlier to a certain degree.
Cuomo ran such a bad campaign. Like, it's not even for working class people. He just ran a bad campaign. Like, I was actually covering his primary campaign pretty intensely. And, you know, he would not answer questions from the press. He would only do like this scripted church appearances on Sundays. It was very much like they just kept him in like a cocoon, and he just thought with the name recognition that he would win, right? And I understand, because even before he entered the race, everyone was already treating it as like, obviously he's going to win. Like, from before he entered the race, everyone thought that, you know, Cuomo was going to be the next mayor of New York. And I understand, because the current field then, I didn't really see other politicians kind of trying to do something different, right? Mamdani was the first one who really just did something completely different. And, you know, he broke the mold and he became a person that people recognized and they could talk to. And, you know, you could see him walking the length of Manhattan, or you could see him with the at the New York Marathon. He was just very accessible. And I think people really like that. And I think Latinos in particular, he made an effort to reach out to them. And of course, he made an effort to reach out to everyone. But Latinos, I mean, I guess I'm Puerto Rican, so it seemed too pricing to me. Because, for example, other people don't even have campaign materials in Spanish, right? And Spanish speakers are, you know, I think it's the second most spoken language in New York. Yet other politicians don't have Spanish materials. Mamdani spoke, like, he tried to speak Spanish. It wasn't just like the flyers.
I saw the videos and he did a pretty good job in some of those videos.
He did a pretty good job with his videos. I mean, my Instagram feed is still mostly just Latin Americans, Puerto Ricans, and everyone was sharing that. I mean, it was like a huge, like, I was logging and everyone, it was in everyone's stories. Everyone was talking about Mamdani speaking Spanish. And, you know, when I started seeing that around May, other people were telling me, like, no, they're Latinos are not going to vote for Mamdani. You know, they're going to vote for Cuomo. And everyone was treating it like this was like a hard truth, right? Like, this was written in stone. And I would hear these things and I would be like, Mamdani's going to win just because he's trying to meet Latinos where they're at. And sometimes it's so simple as, you know, speak our language. I mean, obviously the volunteer army and everything else helped, you know, building relationships. But it seems very, like, silly to me, like, just speak Spanish, like, reach out to a huge population of people.
Yeah, you know what? I want to mention this, and this wasn't necessarily in your NACLA article per se, but at this point in time, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been in our political orbit for some time now, that it's easy to forget that before her, the person before her in her seat was Joe Crowley. And Joe Crowley was another one of these Andrew Cuomo type politicians, in that he felt like he had this entitlement or this privilege or this divine right to win his election seat and to maintain it for as long as he wants. And this just goes to show you that times are changing and people like Andrew Cuomo are being pushed aside for the younger generation, a younger generation that has a pretty serious message, or at the very least, a serious state of intent to challenge the status quo, as we keep mentioning here. Now, I want to go back to the issue of the quote-unquote Latino vote, because in your NACLA article, you cite J.C. Polanco, a lawyer and political analyst of Dominican descent, with the following, quote, "It's pretty hard to just call it being New York, a Latino community, because it's about 100 different communities under one umbrella," end quote. Could you expand on Polanco's theory of the fractured nature of New York's Latino vote, as well as the national perception of the Latino vote as, quote, "a cudgel to advance more conservative social policies," according to the Democratic Party, not according to you and I or people that voted for Mamdani, but the establishment of the Democratic Party that is still dominated by the likes of Andrew Cuomo and, dare I say, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and those type.
Right. So the Latino electorate is fractured, like Polanco says. Because, again, it's very hard to say one thing is Latino when you're talking about two continents, right? You're talking about Central America, you're talking about South America, you're talking about the Caribbean, you're talking about Spanish-speaking communities in the United States. And there's this intention to kind of make it into one thing. And they do this, too, with every demographic to a certain extent, right? Like, there's breakdowns on age, education, race. Sometimes just, like, you live in, like, a rent-stabilized apartment versus you own. Like, that's also kind of a difference. But with Latinos, you know, in New York, you have, like, different immigration waves. Like, so you have New Yorkers and Dominicans who are older and who are maybe more conservative. So, for example, Puerto Ricans, Cuomo had, like, high name recognition because of what he did post-Hurricane Maria and because of prior experience with Mario Cuomo. But that's different, for example, than with Ecuadorians or people who just came in the last 10, 20 years. And those people tend to have other ways of thinking, of voting, other experiences, right? Again, all these cultures, and they want to boil it into one word and say, we're all conservative. And I think at that point, like, I can understand having to simplify it for a political strategy. But what for me is really quite absurd is seeing these events, right? Seeing that they voted for Trump and immediately thinking, oh, so Latinos are conservative. So now we have to become more conservative. So now we have to throw queer people under the bus. So now we have to throw trans people under the bus. And that's, to me, absolutely absurd. I think it's absurd because it just doesn't work that way. I mean, people don't vote for, like, one single thing. People vote in a pragmatic way. You know, most people voted for Trump because of affordability. You know, Mamdani's talking about affordability, so they voted for affordability. And the Democratic Party using the Latino vote to move more towards the right, you know, I think that's a mistake. So saying Latinos are conservative is really kind of misunderstanding Latinos also. And for example, there's always this debate around Latinx, right? And every time people want to make fun of the Democratic Party, they start, oh, maybe we shouldn't have been using the Latinx, right? Like, this turns people off. And yeah, okay, that might be true. I don't think you should stake your electoral strategy on this versus, you know, just going affordability and pocketbook issues. But you shouldn't just throw people under the bus that way, right? You shouldn't throw people, non-binary or trans Latin Americans, under the bus. And it's also just, I mean, I don't know if this is kind of like not with the question, but I just personally think it's ridiculous in the sense that, you know, Latin American countries are plenty on the left. Like, there's very, very strong leftist movements or very strong trans movements. You know, there's very strong queer movements. I mean, the feminist movement in Latin America is a lot stronger than the feminist movement in the United States. The way they're talking about stuff is a lot more, I would say, revolutionary than people are here in the US. So people saying, oh, Latinos are conservative, you know, I think it's just straight up racist, and it's not wanting to engage seriously with the population.
I would also add that to look at the Latino vote or the Latino community as a monolith is also a form of laziness in not understanding the history and the motives why each and every community comes to the United States to begin with. And just in the case of New York City alone, I mean, the idea of the Puerto Rican community or the Dominican community having the same shared experiences of, say, for example, Afro-Hondurans in New York would be absurd and a form of laziness and an unwillingness to understand the history of why these communities would migrate to places like New York City to begin with. I mentioned Afro-Hondurans because 2025 is the 35th anniversary of the Happy Land fire, which killed several people of Garifuna descent in 1990. And so that just speaks volumes and raises the importance of things like a rent freeze that many poor working class residents in New York City sorely need. And so with that said, we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Chris Seda Chavarrier. Chris's latest article in NACLA is entitled How Mamdani Won Over Latinos in New York City. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Under the ruins, through the remains, around the crime and pollution, and tell me where I fit in. South Bronx, New York, that's where I dwell. To a lot of people, it's a living hell, full of frustration and poverty. But wait, that's not how it looks to me. It's a challenge, an opportunity to rise above the stinking debris. You gotta start with nothing, and then you build. Follow your dream until it's fulfilled. My art is my sword. A place in society is my reward. Because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Success is something we all want to taste. Everyone has talent on this earth, and you can take it or leave it for what it's worth. No matter how hard things may seem, you've got the potential. Fulfill your dream, cause we're the future, and it's up to us to make our home rate an A+. Let your mind be pure and free to create. Use the beat in your heart and aim to be great.
That was Grandmaster Cass, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Occupied Washington. Reminding everyone that you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about Mamdani and the Latino Vote with Chris Seda Chavarriere, who's a bilingual reporter and photojournalist. Chris's latest article in NACLA is entitled How Mamdani Won Over Latinos in New York City. So can you tell us about Mamdani's position on ICE and how his promises are a far cry from outgoing New York City Mayor Eric Adams' acquiescence, shall we say, to the Trump administration in general, and border czar Tom Homan in particular? I don't know if you remember this, but earlier this year, I think it was earlier this year, actually, that Eric Adams was sitting with Tom Homan on Fox News, and Tom Homan was basically threatening Eric Adams to, like, play ball or else we will charge you with some things that we're putting on hold at the moment. I seriously doubt that Mamdani would ever find himself in a similar position with Tom Homan, which at the very least is a step in the right direction here.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens with Tom Homan. Because, you know, Mamdani started one his campaign. Like, one of the first viral videos is him yelling at Tom Homan when Homan visited Albany, yes. Right? So, you know, obviously he's an immigrant. He's a Muslim immigrant. He's faced a lot of xenophobia, a lot of Islamophobia, a lot of racism against him. People have been saying that, you know, they should take away his citizenship, all these things, right? These horrible things are kind of symptomatic of where we're at right now. But Mamdani's also kind of walking this tightrope, right? Like, you know, he's a bad spot in the sense that people want to cut off funding for New York because New York is a sanctuary city because they have all these laws protecting migrants. And because of the, you know, past 2 or 3 years where so many migrants have come to New York to, you know, seek respite, seek somewhere where they're safe. So we'll have to see what happens. Obviously, it's good that he's not Adams because Eric Adams and what he did with Trump was really incredible in the bad sense. You know, they tossed out his corruption charges so he would kind of, you know, ally himself with Homan.
Yes.
And yeah. And I remember I was covering, you know, Adams earlier this year, and I went to a press conference and Tom Homan appeared. We didn't know he was gonna be there. He just appeared. He appeared and the journalists weren't expecting that. And so that really kind of symbolized that kind of show me a relationship he was trying to have with the Trump administration. And then, of course, you have Jessica Tisch, who's kind of collaborated on with them on this. Mamdani is keeping her on. So, you know, we'll see what happens with her. So, and I think also with the Trump administration, it's always hard to say something's going to happen because it's such a chaotic administration. And it's also chaotic because, you know, I think people are all pulling in their own directions. So it's interesting to me that Trump said he's holding off on putting the National Guard in New York streets, right?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. What are your thoughts on Mamdani's meeting with Donald Trump? Because initially, at first glance, I thought to myself, this doesn't sound like a good idea. This is not good until you actually see what happens. And like, he came out looking pretty good. And Donald Trump, I mean, there are all sorts of talks about his cognition or lack thereof. But still, generally speaking, what are your thoughts on this meeting? Because it was quite fascinating for reasons that people who thought this was going to be a failure did not expect.
It was fascinating. And I have to say, obviously, I don't think I expected it, but it doesn't surprise me. Because this man, them, is just such a charismatic politician, right? That he's very talented at communicating. He has a great team behind him, advising him. So it doesn't surprise me that it obviously wasn't a train wreck. It did surprise me that it was such a success. you know, and I think, you know, to a certain extent, it's also like game recognizes game. Because Trump is also kind of this, you know, this underdog that became, you know, upset a whole party and became a movement, really, because he turned the Republican Party into kind of a party and into his own movement. And, you know, I think he recognizes himself in Mamdani, that Mamdani is also kind of this underdog that defeated a political dynasty. So I think there's, like, some kinship from very different parts of the political spectrum. And Mamdani was also pretty successful, it seems, at talking, you know, remaining on message on affordability while making it clear that, you know, he wasn't really going to yield on immigration. At least that's what I've kind of perceived from the news articles that have come out. And again, Trump did say he wasn't going to put boots on the ground in the National Guard in New York, but then you have Tobin saying that he will do it. And again, it's kind of like, at the end of the day, who is really calling the shots in the Trump administration? Which is something I'm not sure anyone particularly knows. But I think it was a successful meeting. I think the mayor of New York has to have a working relationship with the president, unfortunately, because that's just a reality. And I think, you know, if it was any other politician, I would have been very disappointed and skeptical. But Mamdani has managed to stay on message for so long in the opposition of so many people, right? And he, you know, he's maybe backed down a little on stuff that he was not going to win. He was just simply not going to win that argument. But he's mostly stayed with the same. Like, he stayed, like, with Israel and Palestine, he has not backed down on that. He has been very clear about it.
Yes, and thank you for pointing that out, because one of the conclusions that I made upon seeing that meeting is that it seems, in spite of his lack of cognition here, it seems like Trump has a lot more respect for the assertiveness of somebody like Mamdani as opposed to the passive acquiescence and weak leadership of people like Chuck Schumer and even Hakeem Jeffries. It seems like he has more respect for Mamdani than those types of politicians that I just mentioned. So towards the end of your article, you mentioned Mamdani also making further connections to Puerto Ricans both in New York and on the island. So could you tell us about both the obvious and not so obvious motives of Mamdani to make these connections? And I say not so obvious because I didn't know there was a Muslim community in Puerto Rico. So please enlighten me.
Yeah, I think it was very moving to me. And it really speaks to how sharp he is in political instincts. And also not just sharp, but how sincere and genuine he is as a politician and as a person, right? Because, you know, even before, like in the Puerto Rican Day Parade, I went there and I thought it was very funny because all the Cuomo posters were on the ground on the floor and people were, you know, people had to pick them up as trash. And that was another moment that I was like, he's going to lose. Like, there's just no way. You know, all these posters on the ground. And then when you see Mamdani with AOC on the floor, you know, and with Nidia Velázquez, right? And these are all people, like, AOC, yes, and Nidia Velázquez have always had, like, allied themselves with Puerto Rico, but not just with Puerto Rico, with kind of the leftist wing of PR. Like, they're not talking to the pro-statehood people. They're not talking to the people who favor Puerto Rico becoming another state, part of the United States, right? That's not who Mamdani is talking to. And
good.
Yeah, good. And he's really quite astute, right? So on that floor, he was basically saying, you know, I think it said, Puerto Rico no se vende, Puerto Rico's not for sale. And then he goes to the island and he repeats that Puerto Rico is not for sale and New York is not for sale. And that really kind of highlights kind of the reach of capital, right, of capitalism, because New York is kind of like the standard of capitalism and then Puerto Rico is like a colony. And then saying that, it's kind of highlighting that relationship and also saying, like, in New York, we also have displacement because of capital. Like, it's not just in PR. And I think, again, that was powerful at its mark, because he's allying himself with leftists in Puerto Rico. And I think that's very sincere. Like, he doesn't have to do this. Like, he can ally himself with the governing party that will remain the governing party for a very long time. But he, again, he allies himself with the underdog. And with regard to his meeting with the Muslim community, I also think it's very interesting and it's very fascinating and it's very heartening. Because the Muslim community in Puerto Rico is, it's mostly Palestinian, or at least Palestinians have a big, are a big part of the Muslim community. There's been, you know, a long history of Puerto Rican and Palestinian kind of, you know, kinship, I want to say, especially because it's an anti-colonial movement.
Yeah, we did a whole show several weeks ago about the parallels between Puerto Rico and Palestine, but please continue.
Right, and then you see the pictures in this mosque, and he's just standing with, like, a, you know, a sea of pro-Palestine flags behind him, you know, Palestinian flags. And again, I just also want to highlight where this mosque is at. This mosque is at a rapidly gentrifying barrio called Caimito. And it's also a barrio that had a long history of kind of environmental activism. And right now, like, down the street, they've been building, like, $3 million houses. Just down the street from that mosque. And so he going there, he highlighting that community, you know, him saying, Puerto Rico no se vende, New York no se vende. I just think it's very, it shows a lot of his character, because he's not getting any political capital out of this, but he's still doing it.
You know, let's focus that a little bit more about one of the main points in his campaign, which is a rent freeze and some degree of affordability towards public housing. Because one of the things that I've mentioned on this show, and I'll address it to you as well, is that I believe that in the 5 years since the pandemic in 2020, during that time, we saw that it was possible for the government to expand Medicaid and to give more health care to the general public, not just New York City, but throughout the entire country. And we saw the same thing as well when it came to a rent freeze in various parts of the country, including New York City. And in the 5 years since, I firmly believe that both political parties have been afraid of what was presented and what was shown as an example of that time period, because it could awaken the body politic to a possibility that they've been told was impossible for decades and for generations. And so I'm curious to know that with that in mind, and with 2020 sort of as a frame of reference here in the context of Mamdani's victory in New York, do you feel like New York residents, or at the very least volunteers that you spoke to, have that same frame of reference that the body politic can be awakened to something that most politicians, if not 99% of them, have said has been impossible for decades and generations?
Oh, I mean, of course. I mean, you're not going to spend so much time campaigning for Mamdani if you don't believe things can change. And I think, again, this is probably a lesson that I think everyone, every politician in the U.S. and beyond can take from Mamdani. There's been a lot of talk about, oh, with Mamdani, socialism, you know, resonated in, like, Kansas. And, you know, maybe no, but the way he built his campaign, I think it should, right? Because he got people out on the street and he built communities. You know, and not, I say hey, but whatever, his whole campaign team, right? They built communities within themselves and they built community with the people who were trying to turn out to vote. And already doing that, like doing that community building, I think is a signal of hope and joy already. Like that sort of like doing that work is already imagining a different world, the future. And for me, you know, I thought it was so ingenious, right? He has this scavenger hunt, he had a soccer tournament, and people met each other, you know, they made relationships, they made friendships through this political campaign. And, you know, I think this can be repeated in other places, because, you know, they're always telling us how we're isolated because of social media, how we're in our bubbles, how, you know, there's this loneliness crisis. And using politics kind of defeat the loneliness crisis and inspire joy, inspire hope, and, you know, things can be better if we come together. I think that can be a worldwide thing, really, because I think it's kind of the other side of the coin. Because Trump, you know, a lot of what he did was create, you know, also relationships, create, you know, somewhere to go to in his rallies, create a sense of momentum, of movement, of us being part of something else. But of course, it was negative, right? It was based on kind of hatred and, you know, all these hatred and violence and conspiracy theories, right? But I think Mam Dami and other politicians have given us another way of going forward and going towards the politics of joy and hope, and things can be better.
Lord knows we need as much hope and joy as possible during these difficult times. And this is precisely why we're going to create a link to your article on our Twitter account so people can learn more and find sort of the same degree of hope and joy that I found in your article as well. Mm-hmm. Now, as we have this conversation today, there have been several post-mortem articles about the quote-unquote Mamdani playbook and comparing this playbook to Trump, which is ridiculous. I think the LA Times also had an article on if the next Zoran could be in Los Angeles. Only time would tell. We can't predict that. But having spoken with volunteers at the grassroots level, what else do you hope people learn from this article that we may not have necessarily addressed? We didn't address the fact that Andrew Cuomo was a staunch Israel supporter, which didn't favor him at all whatsoever. And yeah, what else have we missed that you feel needs to be addressed right now as we wrap up?
I think something I like about New York, about New York politics, is that leftists aren't afraid to kind of get into the fray. So I think another thing that people should take away from the campaign, especially leftists, is that we shouldn't be afraid to kind of put ourselves out there and really, you know, we can't stay at home on Twitter, or we can't just keep being in our bubbles. We have to go out there and convince people, right? And we have to go out there and, you know, be willing to compromise or stand up for ourselves, or really just get into kind of politics, right? To take part of it. And it's something that's something that DSA in New York is doing very well, even if they're sometimes courting controversy with some of their decisions. And yeah, I think the only way the left can begin to mobilize is by mobilizing. And I hope that people in other states and other places start, you know, organizing, become part of collectives, really take part and defeat, you know, the sense of fatalism or the sense of, you know, it's all going to be bad anyway, so why bother? You know, that doesn't help anyone. And I think everyone should start thinking about running, even if it's just like, I don't know, to, you know, to the municipality, to school board. If you're on the left, you should start thinking about being in those places. And this can happen, you know, in New York, or it can happen in Kentucky, or it can happen in Tucson, or it can happen in Puerto Rico. And we have to realize that fascism isn't inevitable, and we can fight back. And we have to start believing that as the left, we can fight back, right? That the U.S. left isn't dead in the water, as some people start to think.
I mentioned before that 2020 had the potential to awaken the body politic to the idea of universal health care and possible rent freezes when necessary. And now, 5 years later, with a candidate like Zoran Mamdani pushing those same things, that may further awaken the body politic in order to push these ideas, not just in New York City, but nationwide as well. And one way to do that, as Chris mentioned during the course of this conversation, is to demystify and break down the myth of the Latino vote as a conservative monolith voting bloc. And with that said, we've been speaking with Chris Seda Chabrier, who's a bilingual reporter and photojournalist. Chris's latest article in NACLA is entitled How Mamdani Won Over Latinos in New York City. And again, we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. But in the meantime, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you very much for being on the show with us, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
If you're a dancer or just a fan, the Way You Move Festival is coming to Washington, D.C. with jams, competitions, and classes. December 13th through the 16th. Whether you're into hip-hop, house, breaking, popping, or locking, we've got you covered with top-notch Small Fries Edition, all-styles dance jam and competition for youth ages 17 and under on the 13th at Edgewood Arts Center. Freshest of all time, 2-vs-2 breaking battle, ages 18 and up, also on the 13th at the Black Cat. The world-famous Juice DeBoo 2-vs-2 competition, DC prelims, on the 14th at the Reach. And masterclasses with International Juice DeBoo judges on the 15th and 16th. All in Washington, D.C., all family friendly, December 13th through 16th. additional event and registration information at wblinc.org/thewayyoumove. Brought to you by the Words, Beats, and Life nonprofit.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, December 5th. Here are some headlines. As of today, the Trump administration is cutting the length of work permits for asylum seekers and refugees in the U.S. from 5 years to 18 months. The shortened timeline applies to new work permits and work permit renewals. The move is the latest in an intensifying crackdown on legal immigration after an Afghan national was charged with shooting two National Guard members. Immigrant advocates say that connection is misplaced and warn the policy will push immigrants out of the workforce, meaning they will not be able to support themselves and their families. The shift will affect hundreds of thousands of legal immigrants. In related news, a U.S. appeals court yesterday delivered a win for President Trump in his effort to keep the National Guard on the streets of Washington, D.C. as part of his immigration crackdown. The ruling temporarily halts a lower court ruling that would have required troops to leave by December 11th, declaring the deployment unlawful and in violation of the district's right to govern itself. More than 2,000 National Guard troops arrived in D.C. shortly after Trump declared in August the city was in the middle of a, quote, crime emergency. Earlier this week, The Washington Post reported that more than 80% of the immigrants arrested in D.C. during the surge in federal law enforcement this year had no prior criminal record. Today's ruling allows the troops to remain pending further order of the court. In other news, the Supreme Court handed Republicans a major win yesterday by allowing them to use a newly redistricted election map for Texas. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
The map aims to add 5 new Republican-held seats to Congress. 5 seats is a huge advantage, as Republicans only lead by 7 seats. The 3 liberal justices on the court dissented, arguing that a lower court was correct to label the new map racial gerrymandering. It is illegal to use gerrymandering to dilute the power of certain groups, but conservative justices seem to view this case as an example of states' rights. Yesterday's ruling adds even more fuel to the fire of the redistricting fight, as both parties seek to gain an advantage. States to watch in the future include California, Missouri, and North Carolina. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
And in more news, yesterday in Sudan, a brutal attack targeting children signals that war crimes have spread far beyond Darfur province. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
Yesterday, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, attacked a kindergarten and other sites, killing at least 47 people, most of whom were children. This heartbreaking attack occurred in the South Kordofan province, east of Darfur, where last month the RSF came to dominate, but also rampaged through the streets of Al-Fashir. The UN Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, has been warning for days that violence will spread to the east of the country as neither side nears collapse. The UN has also warned of atrocities in the region, even as foreign governments fail to heed the call. Weapons continue to flood into the country from the UAE, Russia, and more. The strategy of the RSF seems clear. Push further east towards the capital of Khartoum, which the army recaptured earlier this year. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.